Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. We are here at the Firehouse World Conference in San Diego, and today we are looking at some of the issues that face fire service leaders out here on the West Coast. Our panelists today include Kim Allen, Anthony Castros, and Ed Hadfield. We'll go around real quick and get an introduction and a short bit of biographical information. Welcome, Kim, and can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yes, thank you. I own a company called Fire Presentations, and I work with fire departments across the United States and Canada on company officer development, chief officer development in areas of leadership, conflict resolution, discipline, sexual harassment, communication skills. I have a bachelor's degree in management and a master's degree in organizational management, and I am completing my doctorate degree in organizational leadership right now. That's my background.
Okay, and Anthony Castros, a little background on yourself, please.
I've been in the fire service 22 years, currently a line battalion chief with the Sacramento Metropolitan Fire District. In addition to that role, I'm the project manager for our command training center. Also have a business called Firefighter Inspiration, Readiness, and Education, and been running that about 12 years now, focusing on leadership tactics and specifically promotional processes, specifically the assessment center. Had a book published by Fire Engineering a couple years ago called Mastering the Fire Service Assessment Center, and do a lot of teaching around the country on that specific topic and the peripheral topics like leadership and tactics and strategy.
Okay, thank you. And Ed Hadfield.
Welcome back to San Diego, Pete.
Thank you. Thank you. Great. It's a very nice city this time of the year.
That's right. Well, we're glad to have you back. Ed Hadfield, I'm a division chief with the City of Coronado Fire Department here in San Diego County. About 23 and a half years in the fire service as a professional firefighter. And I, too, also run a training development company by the name of Firetown Training Specialist. We're very fortunate that we have the opportunity to train firefighters throughout the United States, focusing in on command leadership, focusing in firefighter truck company operations, firefighter safety survivability, and officer and professional growth and development for line and command staff personnel. We have put together a program called Captain's College, which is very popular throughout the United States, and it's one of the reasons that we're here to talk today, is talk about successional development and mentoring and career planning.
Okay, thank you, and for everybody listening, we will include links for all three folks that are joining us today at the bottom of the podcast player page, so if you can click on those links, you can learn a little bit more and see some of the services that everyone on the panel is offering. Kim, we'll start with you. Out here in California, it was January 1, 2008, a new law was passed in the state of California dealing with disciplinary actions. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that's affecting the fire service?
Sure. The law is referred to as a Firefighter Bill of Rights, or AB 220 was the code for the law. And it's affecting the disciplinary process in the fire service. I'm just going to give you a brief summary of it because it's pretty extensive. It's a three-hour class in and of itself, so I'm giving you the crash course version here. Pre-AB 220, if you were going to discipline a firefighter, if the discipline was going to result in a loss of property right, or substantial discipline is what it's referred to as, that's what the law defined as discipline technically. So a counseling session, an oral warning, or a written reprimand weren't considered discipline. They were considered pre-disciplinary procedures. So at a loss of property right pre-AB 220, you were entitled to union representation. The major change that AB 220 brought was this. Now, if you are entering into a questioning process with a firefighter or an investigation and you have any reason to believe that the answers they're giving you or would give you could result in a written reprimand or above, you have triggered the Firefighter Bill of Rights. And what that means is they're now entitled to union representation at a written reprimand, which in my opinion was a little bit irrelevant because I think any officer out there, a company officer or chief officer that is engaging in the discipline process and somebody asks for union representation, you give it to them. You let them have their union rep there if they want to have their union rep there. But what this said was the law doesn't allow you to deny union representation at a written reprimand or above. So once the Firefighter Bill of Rights is triggered, now you have procedural process to follow. And that's why it's actually technically called the Firefighter Procedural Bill of Rights. And so what it says is the firefighter has rights to procedures that will be followed, which includes things like you are not allowed to have more than two interrogators in the room. We hate to use interrogation because that sounds so harsh, like they should have a light shined in their eyes and bamboo stuck under their fingernails while they're being asked questions. But the idea is that interviewers, if you have a company officer in the room and a battalion chief in the room, you can't have somebody else asking them questions. You can only have two people. You have to give them reasonable breaks. You can't cuss at them during the investigative interview. You can't go and search their locker without their knowledge of it or an attorney present or their consent. You can't, there's a few other things that it covers. You can't have a written file that you keep on them or a log without you informing them that you have it and they have the right to see your negative comments, things like that. So it's basically just a new process that you have to follow if you're in the discipline proceedings with a firefighter. And it's affected only the state of California, so not the fire service as a whole.
And has that been grandfathered into, for instance, the past records? If a firefighter did receive a written warning in 2004, but the officer did not make them aware of it, does that kind of cover the old actions, or is that just 2008?
It needs to cover any file or documentation that you have of them. So if it's in their personnel file and it was 4 years old, yes, they have access to see it. And they also have a right to respond to anything that's put in their file after January 1st, 2008, that's negative. They have up to 30 days to respond to it and say, hey, I disagree, I think this is bogus, or whatever it is, this negative remark on my performance evaluation, it's erroneous, I want it removed. They have up to 30 days to do that, and then the department has up to 30 days to say, no, we're not removing it, or yes, you're right, that's a legitimate concern. So it's grandfathered in the sense that they can see the old documents, but any infractions that came up or any behavior that occurred before that date does not fall under the Firefighter Bill of Rights.
Okay. Have any of you seen any of those cases come out yet where they've used that to I guess, protect the firefighter as it starts off? Or any cases where it's been used?
Yeah, I've used it definitely, and I think the key is to be proactive. I think that the intent is great, and that is that we want to ensure that a firefighter who's being interrogated is protected from the lowest level of the interrogation. In other words, we want to make sure that there's no, like the Miranda rights would be for a person who's being read their rights. So an example that I've used is if I have a firefighter who's being drug tested, I actually bring in the labor representative ahead of time to let them know the procedures we follow, that we follow policy, and that we follow the contract, and then they just observe the interrogation. There's no need to interact with the labor representative, but I believe it's important to be proactive and let them know the basis of the interrogation. So they know that this isn't, we're not picking on Joe, let's say. We're not picking on him just because. But we actually have reasonable cause. For example, in the case of a drug test, you need to have some reasonable cause, and you need to have specific policies that you're following that create and warrant that level of interrogation. So that to me is a pretty simple example. The times that I think it's a judgment call are the ones that are less critical than, say, a drug test. Those are the ones that I find my captains really don't understand when they should afford that to their firefighters. The question is, well, what if I want to, I'm just trying to do my job. And I just want to talk to him about doing his job. Do I have to have a union representative there?
If you think talking to him about doing his job is going to result in a written reprimand, then yes. But otherwise, and I think that is a huge confusion for a lot of company officers in a lot of departments. Well, what if I just want to ask him some questions about this or that? It is actually pretty cut and dry. If right. you think the questions you're going to ask this person is going to result exactly
yeah.
in a written reprimand or above, then you've triggered it. It's right. it's really that simple.
But I think it's important for everybody to understand, and particular company officers, is that as a supervisor, when you are discussing the performance of an individual, as this may lead to a written reprimand, it does not require a union representation to be in the room when you are discussing the performance of the individual. And that's the big thing that people have to understand. This Firefighter's Bill of Rights is nothing new to the public safety industry. Police Officer's Bill of Rights, also known as 3300, has been around for 30 years, and anybody that has been involved in the fire service in an arson investigation unit is well aware of 3300 and all the rules and regulations. So case law has been established as of 30 years ago with 3300 in law enforcement. What people fail to understand and the knee-jerk reaction that occurred when Firefighter Bill of Rights came out was the misconception that a company officer can no longer do his job, and that's not the truth. The truth is that you continue to do your job in a fashion that you've always done it before. Just recognizing that at certain aspects, for instance, company officers, by and large, have kept supervisory note files. It's a very important tool for a supervisor to keep a supervisory note file on an employee to document those items that show strong performance and those areas that show weak performance. If something within that note file is going to be negative and result in some type of disciplinary process, then you simply have to notify the employee that, you know, this is in here, you have a right to respond to this, but this will show up in this type of form of documentation, i.e. your performance evaluation, or this may be leading down to, you know, some level of discipline. You give the individual a copy of that note. And if the individual says, well, I want my union rep in here, then you say, that's fine, bring your union rep or a representative in here. And as the representative stands in the room, you hand the note to the individual and you say, okay, I followed due process and the correct procedures, and that's the end of it. It does not stop the supervisors from doing their job. What it does is it protects employees from supervisors that were doing their job incorrectly. And most importantly is what's important for everybody to understand is that those rights have always been there. Skelly rights, Weinberger rights have always been there. It's what triggers the substance of you moving into that direction. If you as an organization have been doing the disciplinary process correctly all along, this is a no-brainer. If you've been winging it, then it's a cultural shock to your organization. So all the hubbub of what went on when the Firefighters Procedural Bill of Rights came into existence has pretty much calmed the nerves, because when everybody played it out, they said, you know what, we're doing it right, and if we're not, we've corrected our administrative procedures, we've put procedures in place to see that we're doing things right, and you move down the road. As Anthony said, the failure to force yourself to interact with the union representation, again, it's not there. The union rep is simply there to make sure that you are following the procedures set forth in policy and in place in that organization, and he has seen to it that the individual's rights are being protected. He is not there to be Perry Mason. He is not there to interject or stop the process unless that person's rights are being violated at that time. And it's important for supervisors to continue to understand that the best form of correcting performance is that counseling, coaching session that is documented, and the individual is given a copy of that documentation. He signs it. He knows that it goes into the supervisory note file, and he knows that this can lead, if poor performance continues, to the areas of formalized discipline. And if he chooses to have somebody in the room while you're explaining that to him, hey, bring them and bring a band too.
Okay.
Yes, and that is the reason what he just said is why I recommend if someone says, can I have my union rep present, even if it's a counseling session, of course you can. I can't see this, you were tardy. I'm giving you a counseling session here. It's not that big of a deal. But if you want your union rep and you can get the person here in the next hour when I'm holding the meeting, you can absolutely have them, because the purpose of the union rep is to make sure that as the supervisor, I follow due process. The person is not there to defend the person, to advise them not to speak, to tell them not to incriminate themselves, to run the meeting. They are there to make sure you follow due process. And if they're doing anything other than that, the supervisor has every legal right to say, close your mouth. Close your mouth. I am running this meeting, obviously, in a very polite and professional way. Please stop talking. I'm running the meeting. And if the person doesn't, you have a legal right to say you need to find another union rep.
Okay.
So the purpose of the union rep is to make sure I follow due process. And if I'm not, I welcome it. Tell me if I am not following due process. It's for your benefit to have the person there to make sure that they're confirming that, yes, you did what you were supposed to do. But they're definitely not there to run the meeting.
Okay. The next topic I'd like to touch on is lawsuits in the fire service, something that seems to come up every week in the last couple of years in the fire service. I guess one of the biggest cases I can think of here on the West Coast would be the incident a few years ago in Los Angeles, the dog food incident, as they called it. As officers currently and for aspiring officers, what is some advice you have for when it comes to a lawsuit, when you make your decision on whether or not to discipline somebody or to take action on somebody's actions, follow-up action on somebody's actions? What are your thoughts and thought processes on lawsuits?
I take the viewpoint, I took the viewpoint as a company officer, as a battalion chief, and now as a division chief, is that you do not allow the fear of litigation to stop you from doing your job. Any company officer that is performing in the capacity of an officer is effectively removing the exposure of liability from not only the personnel that are assigned to him, but also to the organization, and more importantly, the city. The exposure of liability is broad, and you as a company officer are charged with seeing to it that you operate and make decisions based upon a very strong risk management model. It is imperative that company officers understand that they are completely responsible for the actions of their personnel assigned to them. And that if you are doing your job as an officer of continually utilizing discipline, and discipline is a good thing, and you are utilizing a strong disciplined approach to how you manage your personnel and you manage your resources and you manage your actions, then you remove that exposure of liability. Now, can we completely absolve ourselves of certain behaviors or certain actions or certain things, as Gordy Graham would say, cats in row, people are going to make stupid decisions. And it's important that people understand, particularly people listening to this podcast, that understand that most of the reasons why lawsuits exist is because officers from company officer and above have failed to properly either A, handle the situation and address it, B, effectively utilize progressive discipline to address it, investigate the incident, and D, to effectively put into place policies to eliminate that from occurring in the future. If you look at case law and you look at those large sum lawsuits that have occurred within the fire service, most of the time it's because we didn't do anything about it in a timely and effective manner, and we didn't follow the proper procedures to appropriately and adequately address the actions that occurred, no matter what the case. So an officer is the first line of defense. In the station, when you have an incident that you feel is going to raise awareness or bring about an exposure of liability to the organization, and again, to the community or to the city, it's important that you investigate it, that you take appropriate action, you make the proper and correct notifications, and you utilize whatever form of discipline is necessary. Sometimes that form of discipline can be just simply calling the members or the person into the office and having a counseling session. Or it could be a complete getting the battalion chief or chief officer to respond to have that person taken away from the station for whatever reason it may be. And Anthony brought it up. Could be one where you have reasonable cause to believe that the individual is under the influence of some type of alcohol or narcotic, and that it's your job to make sure that you look at what's best for the organization as a whole, and not necessarily 100% of how you can keep this item or this action suppressed to eliminate people from getting in trouble or eliminate yourself from getting in trouble. Again, open, porous, trustworthy organizations have an understanding of what their mission is, and their mission is to protect the community. And to protect the community, sometimes certain people have to be managed differently.
You know what's funny is they get the nail on the head on open. I think what's effective as a company officer, if you're out there and you're a company officer and your crew or a member of your crew is doing something that you don't want to see put on the front page of the paper tomorrow, or you don't want to see have your mom read about, or your wife see, or your girlfriend or whatever, or if you're a female captain, you don't want to see your husband or your kids see on the paper, then you need to do something about it. And firefighters want strong leadership. And I think what we're going to talk about tonight, we're just getting going here, is we're going to talk about a lot of symptoms of poor leadership. And I think right now there's a huge, what I call the great leadership void in the fire service right now. And it's not that we don't have phenomenal fire ground commanders or that we don't have people that we want to follow. But what we don't have is truly selfless leaders who are willing to make unpopular decisions. And that unpopular decision may be, guys, change the channel. It may be, put that away. It may be, stop that behavior. And that's going to be unpopular, maybe with just your crew. Or if you're a battalion chief or even a fire chief, it may be unpopular with 1,000 people in your organization, in your fire department. And so when you mentioned as the example that we were talking about the famous dog food incident, you know, I believe that discipline, like Ed said, discipline's a good thing, but it's from the root word disciple, student. And we need to realize that discipline is not just a reactive process. Discipline is proactive. It's positive. It's things like team building, training, setting the example, and communicating with your crews on what you expect, and doing it in a positive way. It doesn't have to always be a reactive, oh, you did something wrong, now I'm going to discipline you. I believe discipline is simply enforcing boundaries, and you can do that in a very positive way, as well as unfortunately, in a way that's reactive and ultimately punitive. So what I like to do in my battalion is create a very strong team atmosphere. There's about 40 of us in my battalion, and I like to create an environment where they know what the boundaries are, and we spend enough time with each other, and we have core values that are reflective of our organization's core values that are positive, and they know, not just the captains, but the firefighters, even the least senior knows, my expectations as their battalion chief, and they're a derivative of the organization's expectations. They have it in writing. They have a document from me that they get when they come into our battalion. This is my expectations, and this is how I expect you to behave. And whatever core values or morals you bring to the table, that's great as a foundation, but here's what I'm adding to it, and here's what the organization's adding to that. And while you're here for 10 days a month, for 24 hours at a time, these are your boundaries. And that's, again, not in a punitive sense, not in a, you know, thou shalt, but hopefully through team building and strong leadership, I can create an environment where the company officers are doing it and they're setting an example. And I can't be everywhere at once. I've got 10 stations in just my battalion. I can't be everywhere at once. I need to trust my captains to set the example. And I believe that's how you mitigate the dog food stuff from happening. You know, I think that's how you mitigate the little stuff, is let them police themselves.
Okay. Kim.
And the number one responsibility of a company officer, and as Ed was saying, they have such an influential position in the fire service. They are the most powerful position in the fire service because they're the front line. They're the liaison between management and labor. And they often don't realize that their number one responsibility is to create more leaders. And they do that by making principle, ethical-based decisions and setting the role model example as a leader for what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And so people see in them what the behavior is supposed to look like. So as a leader, they have to be the change they want to see. They have to be the policy enforcement they want to see. They have to be the instructor and teacher that they want to see in their firefighters. So that's their number one responsibility. And in my opinion, the reason that huge leadership gap exists that Anthony was referring to is because fire departments are not investing in mentoring in their departments and leadership training all the way to the front line. Exactly. So they might invest in leadership training for their command staff. Well, you know, these are our big leaders, and that's important. Or they'll say, the command staff already knows it. Let's give it to the company officers. But they're not doing it up and down and across the chain of command, where everyone in the department has a brainwashing of the core values and the mission of the department. They know what's expected of them, and they're being trained over and over and over how to respond to the public, how to respond in conflict with somebody in the station. What do you do when you see somebody make a racial slur towards somebody else? What do you do when you see somebody treat the member of the public poorly because they're in a poverty class style of living and you're tired of the frequent flyer guy who keeps, you know, calling 911 every week? They're not getting brainwashed in it. And in crisis, conflict, or under stress, people revert to their most commonly held training or commonly held beliefs and core values. And I'll just give you a quick example of this. Organizational theorist Carl White talks about U.S. pilots who are trained in North American airplanes and they're trained in European airplanes, and so they fly in both places. So the European pilots, the planes are identical, except they vary by one thing. The ejection system is different by location. So in Europe, the pilots eject from the bottom of the plane, and in North America, they eject from the top of the plane. So in Europe, they train these U.S. pilots. When you find yourself in trouble or an emergency, you roll the plane upside down and you eject from the top. Then they can parachute to safety. Well, when these pilots transfer to the United States and now they're flying the North American planes, those eject from the top. So they're retrained and they tell them, look, in an emergency, you no longer need to roll the plane. Now you simply eject from the top of the plane. You would think, okay, that's pretty simple. Well, what happens is when these pilots find themselves under stress, crisis, or emergency, they revert to their most deeply held training. They roll that plane upside down and they eject themselves to their death, because that's what people do. They cling to the thing they've been trained in the most deeply and the most ingrained training in their life. Unfortunately, when you're talking about leadership issues, conflict resolution, ethical-based decisions, and things like that, the training that they've had may be a series of bad habits they've developed throughout their life. So you come into the fire service, and one of your jobs as a company officer is to parent. Being a company officer is a lot like being a parent, which is a lot like trying to nail Jell-O to a tree. So they have a real challenge to basically take these people who, especially the new generation, don't have a tremendous amount of work ethic. They don't have an understanding of mission, vision, values, and beliefs that a department might hold. And so they think, hey, we got a new rookie in. Here's our core values. Here's our mission. Here's our vision. Now get out there and do a good job. And then they can't understand why, under conflict, stress, and crisis, they're doing something else, because that's not their most deeply ingrained training. So if you want to see out of your firefighters as a company officer that they not put dog food in somebody's dinner, you are going to have to brainwash them what you would think is common sense in some certain areas. And frankly, I think that was an issue outside of the you have to know the whole story behind that LA issue.
You have to know the whole story.
Yeah, and it's the guy that got that was the biggest practical joker in the department. So not that one action justifies another, but he actually did something almost identical to that. So if you don't want to see that in your firefighters as a company officer, you better train them up one side and down the other on what your department's mission, vision, and core values are.
I think part of the brainwashing is setting the example. And so funny. One of the common questions I ask firefighters in these workshops is, what's your leadership style? And now I lead by example. Because they've heard it before. It's easy to say, I lead by example. Well, what does that look like?
What is your example?
Yeah. Okay. What's your example look like? And how often are you leading by example? Is it just on the fire ground, the drill ground? I mean, or is it 100% of the time, 24 hours a day, how you treat them, how you treat everyone else? And what's amazing and powerful is how firefighters will follow you. I had somebody recently coined the phrase, and I'm sure it's nothing new to me, but nothing earth-shattering, but very true, is that firefighters don't always listen, but they're always watching. And I think as an officer, to truly set the example, you really need to model. It's more like modeling the behavior. I think modeling the behavior gives a better depiction of what you're doing. You're saying this is how it's supposed to be. And what I find is that a lot of times captains have a different threshold of when they're on stage. Some of them think it's when it's a call. Okay, that's when it's important. Oh, when it's a certain kind of call, okay, then I'll do the right thing. When it's when the media is around, or when people are watching, when there's cameras around, and they fail to realize that some of them it's when I'm at work. Well, no, it's all the time. It's 24/7, not 24/10 a month. It's 24/7, 365. You are now holding a huge, important position in the community. You are going to be scrutinized. If you do something that's illegal, immoral, it will smear not only yourself and your family, but your fire department and the fire service in general. We've seen that time and time and time again, because you were talking about the recent lawsuits. Every time we have one that hits the papers, it smears that. It's like an epicenter of a nuclear blast that hits the entire fire service. The epicenter just happens to be that fire department. But we hear about it all over the country, about what happened in this state or that state. And it's because officers fail to realize that the threshold is not a time of day when they arrive at work or a type of call that they go on. The threshold is the moment they get the badge on them. The threshold just came and went. And you just went to a new level of expectation and behavior you should be modeling.
Okay, well, we'll be right back here on Radio at Firehouse.com. We're live at Firehouse World. We'll come back and we'll pick up on what Kim had mentioned a few minutes ago with mentoring, and we'll also look at succession planning as we finish up the podcast.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Leadership West Coast Style. We're here at Firehouse World, and we have guests Kim Allen, Anthony Castros, and Ed Hatfield. The next topic that we're going to look at is mentoring. Kim, you brought it up, and I think the last bit on lawsuits sort of started going that way as to mentoring what a fire officer should be doing in his or her position. So, Anthony, we'll start with you on this one. Do you have any best practices for mentoring the new officers or the up-and-coming officers?
I don't know if they'd be called best practices. They're practices that I've seen and that I like to use. The first one is I have to be approachable all the time. We all talk about an open door policy. Outside of my office, I have a sign that says the Battalion 7A Internal Customer Service Center, and it's got an arrow pointing into my office. Actually, Battalion 7. It's not just to my shift. I believe that, that all the battalion chiefs in my organization aspire to this, that we're the internal customer service reps for our battalions on our shifts. And I'm proud to be part of that peer group. And I think we all have the same philosophy that we are there as a support mechanism for our troops. One of the things I like to do is I have in my office what I call my listening chair. And when I'm behind my desk on my computer doing email or whatever, and the phone's there, I'm easily distracted. When one of my firefighters or anybody in my battalion comes in, or anybody comes in my office, I physically get up from behind my desk and go sit in the listening chair. And it's for me to listen. The thought is that it's for them to listen, but it's for me to listen. And I sit in that chair, and there's no barrier between us. It's just two chairs that are away from my desk, and the barriers are taken away, and then I purposely will just focus in on what they're saying. And I think this has had a tremendous impact on my battalion because it got around really quick that I have this listening chair. And, of course, a lot of people that didn't know thought it was for them to listen, but it's for me to listen. And it sends the message that I care about whoever I'm sitting here talking to. So if my cell phone rings, I don't answer it. If my desk phone rings, I don't answer it. I probably shouldn't say that because my boss might be listening to this. But the point is my message that I'm sending to that person in that chair is, you are the most important person to me right now. And that trust and that value message I'm sending to them really, I believe, sets the tone for future mentoring. Because if they don't believe that I truly care about them, to just listen to them, they really aren't going to hear what I have to say about career development or helping them out and whatever. So they know that I really care and that I will listen. And that's a good practice, I believe. So I think it sets the tone. Another thing that I like to do is I like to ask around. I'm always asking. I'm asking my captains if they want to promote and if any of their crew members want to promote, how I can help. Not only promotion, but other career goals they have, any skill sets they want to develop. I may not be the person to go to, but I'll find the person to go to. I'll create the avenue for that. I'll let them know what class that Ed Hadfield or Kim Allen has coming up, or whatever's going on at Firehouse, for example, or whatever. And so that they know that customer service center isn't just a cute little piece of paper that Castro's put on his wall, but it actually is a philosophy I live by. Another aspect of mentoring is helping them develop a goal or a plan. For example, if a firefighter wants to promote, right now I've got three firefighters in my battalion who want to promote to captain. Their captains are totally bought off on it. I bought off on it, and we conduct regular training in our command training center for them, scenario-based training for them, high-fidelity counseling sessions. Kim mentioned that absent any other training that overrides your normal upbringing or values or training that you had years ago, you're going to do whatever feels easy. Well, I like to practice high-fidelity training where we actually do counseling simulations. We talk about fireground simulations. I like doing counseling simulations where I give a scenario, we get a role player, and they play it out. That's a tremendous tool where we actually have somebody doing something stupid, and the captain, the aspiring captain, has to actually stop the behavior and interact and not only stop it, but help the member understand why they have to change course on their behavior. And I found that to be really, really powerful. But going back to the beginning, I think if the troops know that their captain or battalion chief or whomever is truly there to listen and cares about them and has a bunch of tools available, that they'll come to you. Because without that, you can have all the theories in the world. If they don't come to you for help, then you're not a mentor.
I think, you know, I've been very fortunate to work with an organization, the Coronado Fire Department, that we looked at successional development strongly to put forth the organization's vision. And the successional development, you know, a lot of organizations give lip service to it, and that's exactly what they do. They talk about it. They put together a committee. They borrow a task book from this department to this department. They change the heading, and they say, you know, we have successional development, when in fact, really, they don't. What they've done is they've checked a box. And mentoring, mentoring is a lot like what Anthony talks about. Is mentoring is taking the individual person. My organization looked at starting the successional development program from the time that we wrote the job announcement for the entry-level firefighter paramedic, because we looked at it from the standpoint of what kind of people do we want to bring into our organization that are going to be future leaders. Now, to coin a statement from Colonel P.P. McCoy, quoting Hercules of 2000 or 500 B.C., he said that on the field of battle, when you look at 100 people, there are 10 that shouldn't even be there. Now, you can look at any organization, and you can take 10% that should not even be there. 80 of those are nothing more than targets. Well, when you look at an organization and organizational leadership and organizational theory, as Kim's doctorate will be, you look at those 80 as those people that are just the people that show up to work, do a good job, collect a paycheck. 9 of the remaining are your fighters. And of those fighters, those are the people that will take the battle. And those are the people that you need to enable. Those are the people that you need to feed. Those are the people you need to protect. And those are the people that you need to supply. When you look at an organization, basically those 9 or how many ever percentage that may work out to be, 9% or 10%, those are the people that are driving the organization. And those are the people that are taking the organization's mission and carrying it forth and seeing to it that the organization becomes that of a quality organization. However, the one remaining person on the field of battle is the warrior. That is the leader. And that is the person that his or her responsibility is to see to it that the 80 fight like the 9. Now, when you look at an organization like that, that is true succession development, because it must be led by a warrior. It must be led by a leader, and a leader creates belief. Now, we look at 4 standards of leadership to enable us to create belief in our vision that will enable us to move our organization forward, which is truly organizational succession development. First of all, that is procedures, mission, and purpose. And when you look at procedures and mission and purpose, what is our goal? Our goal is to protect lives. Our goal is to stabilize the incident, and our goal is to protect the property and the community in which we serve. But the first and foremost is protect lives. You ask any city manager, you ask any citizen, why does the fire department exist? It is to protect lives. Second is execution. You must have an organization that executes. All the classroom training in the world is great, but if you can't get people to pull hose, to open up the roof, to force entry, to search buildings in a timely fashion, then you don't have a fire department. You have an organization that runs around on $250,000 to $300,000 fire apparatus with 4 well-paid, very handsome individuals or females, and then what do you have? You have a pseudo fire department. Okay? You don't really have a fire department. The third concept is discipline. And discipline is, again, a positive approach to maintaining a comprehensive, trustworthy organization, and trustworthy from the standpoint of the community. And then last but not least is pride. You have to have pride in your department. A fire chief that I knew that really wasn't very well liked, fire chief, made a very prolific statement. He used to ask the recruits at the academy, what's the best fire department in the nation? And of course they would stumble on, various names and acronyms. And he would say, it's the one that you work for. And if you work for, Tippaloo, fire department, then that's the best fire department in the nation. If you work for Coronado Fire Department, that's the best fire department in the nation. Or if you work for LAFD or FDNY, that's the best fire department in the nation. Now, when you look at organizationally, you look at that concept and that model, and you look at how you bring people into an organization, that starts the bedrock, not even the foundation, because the foundation's above the bedrock. That's the bedrock of a successional development plan. Now, carry it forth from there. You bring them into the organization, how they're brought into the organization, their understanding of mission and purpose, how we train them, how we impart our organizational philosophy. As Kim said earlier, you know, she likes to use the term brainwashing and saying, you know, you need to tell these people, you need to tell these people. And we do. We need to tell these people that this is how we operate, and here are the reasons why. Now, one thing I tend to disagree with what the current philosophy of what a lot of people have said in the fire service is that the younger generation of firefighters come in and have a poor work ethic. And I completely disagree. The younger generation of firefighters have the same work ethic as the previous generation. They've been allowed by the organization to have a poor work ethic because typically the company officer that is in charge of them has a poor work ethic. And therefore, when you look at the young firefighter that has come into an organization and you put him with strong people, okay, here's a concept in mentoring. You put them with the right people. What type of persona will that young firefighter develop into? It will be the persona of the fire officer in which he is working for, okay? And again, I'll go back to Colonel McCoy. In McCoy's Marines, he led the Third Army into Iraq. It was a group of the now generation military kids going in to protect our freedom, and they took on the persona of the warrior. Why? Because he did the right thing. He led from the front. He knew what his purpose was. He executed. He maintained a disciplined army, and he had pride in what he did and who he was and who he was for. And that's when we look at the development of character in our people. Now, when you want to step out of the box, and I don't mean to take up a lot of time on this, then you start looking at the foundation of succession development. And those are the programs. Programs are individual performance standards, company performance evaluation, development process for first-class firefighter, engineer or apparatus operator academies, and development processes that allow people to enter into a department-sponsored program that will help prepare them for the next step, okay? Then you get into your officership. An officer corps and officer development is really important and strategic to a succession development program because the officer corps, the company officers, are the backbone of the fire service. Now, proudly, and I'm going to be a little boastful here, and excuse me, Coronado Fire Department is entering into their second year of a 13-week company officer development program. Our people voluntarily will attend classes 3 days a week for 5 hours for a total of 15 hours a week for 13 weeks to develop into comprehensive, well-trained, highly qualified company officers. What's the investment that we give back to them? We provide them free training. We provide them 2 organized staff rides, 2 administrative staff rides, and we provide them with a one-on-one mentoring program with somebody who is chosen outside of our organization that will help to strengthen certain areas that they may have been struggling on in that were identified during the company officer development program. And I'll just use real quick, if we have an officer that is having some difficulty or challenges developing into a strong incident commander, we will put him with an individual who is a tenured company officer that has strong command skills, concepts, and has a system in place that will help bring that individual along. And it's typically outside our organization. Not that we don't have well-qualified people within our organization, but you're never a prophet in your own city. Now, to go further, we've collaborated with not only areas and other disciplines within our city, risk management, human resources. The city manager speaks to them day one in the first 3 hours of class, telling them his expectations, which Anthony discussed earlier. The city manager and the fire chief talk to them day one about expectations of the city and expectations of the organization from a company officer standpoint. City manager makes it very clear. Every decision you make should be that of the city manager. If you think that I would make that decision, then you make that decision. If you think I would not make that decision, then don't do that. It's a very clear expectation. Now, collaboration outside our organization. And I'm going to throw a little pitch this way. San Bernardino City Fire Department graciously opened their arms to our organization and Deputy Chief Matt Frattis and Battalion Chief Mike Alder. Great guys. Great guys. Graciously brought our organization's candidates into their organization and helped in that development process and continue to help in that development process today. And there are other organizations and disciplines such as, our own police department, again, our risk management department, our human resources department, and other outside instructors that came in to help develop our people into very good company officers. Last testing process, we had two openings. We had two highly qualified people fill that role. We're doing it again this year. And then it didn't stop there. We took it. We continued to take it to the next level, to division chief development, where each division chief is in charge of his budget. Each division chief is in charge of multiple programs. He has a multidisciplined approach to how he does things. He's oversought by the fire chief. The fire chief has ongoing meetings with individual company officers to see that the things are moving forward. And that portion of the development process, so they become politically astute, they become understanding of city development, city budgetary processes, the development and vision and forecasting of budgetary items, because that's a main portion of their workload. And then, of course, personnel development and personnel growth plans and development of performance evaluations and so on and so forth. Even our own city manager is involved in the development of our division chiefs by having regular meetings with them to help them prepare for the level of what? Fire chief. So we're doing it all up the board. And I'm very anxious, because I know that what we're going to end up producing, when it's all said and done, when I'm able to walk out of here, is we will have multiple warriors, not just fighters. And we won't have a bunch of people that are operating at 80%. We're going to have people that are maybe in the 80%, but they're fighting like the 9.
Okay.
I want to clarify something before I address the mentoring succession planning issue. I noticed the title of your show today is Leadership West Coast Style. And when we look at the West Coast and all the way to the state of California, I have to say that a lot of what we're talking about today is not West Coast style. California, our license plate motto should be the zero responsibility state, because as a state, that's pretty much California. We're the most litigious state in the entire union. We file more lawsuits against anybody than any state in the United States. And we do that because surely somebody has to be to blame for everything but us. So we're not a real big state on taking personal responsibility and accountability. So in my opinion, the mentoring and succession training aspect has to start with that mentality, which is getting people to take responsibility and making themselves accountable up, down, and across the chain. Everybody in the fire service has no problem making themselves accountable up the chain for the most part. Now, that's the person who's responsible for my performance evaluations and discipline, and I'll make myself accountable up the chain. Some people have enough leadership skills to make themselves accountable across the chain. We're on the same level. We're both battalion chiefs, or we're both captains, and I'll make myself accountable to you. Very few real leaders will step up and make themselves accountable down the chain to the people they lead, mentor, and supervise. And I think that's an important element of mentoring, is saying, as a supervisor, I'm going to make myself accountable to you. And the most effective way to make yourself accountable up, down, and across the chain is allow people to give you a 360-degree evaluation. Give them an evaluation form to fill out on you that tells you where you are competent in your performance issues, in your leadership issues, and your ability to do your job up, down, and across the chain. The other area that I think needs to be a real focus, and Ed and Anthony both hit on this pretty well, but I think departments need to be concentrating not just on the acting captains programs or the chief programs or the academies that they're putting people through a lot of those focus on the aspects of being a company officer as far as taking incident command or discipline or enforcing policy, and all those are vital and they're very important. Very few departments are engaging in in-depth mentoring programs that grab a hold of people that want to or are aspiring to be a company officer or a chief officer and saying, you know what, I'm going to meet with you once a week and we are going to talk about what your career goals are, where you want to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, what it's going to take to get you there. So for example, you know, maybe our department requires that you have a bachelor's degree to be able to qualify as a battalion chief. And that's something that's a career goal for you. How are we going to get you to that? Because right now you're not there, but you've got some college credits. What goals are you going to set to get to that if you want to be a battalion chief? Meeting with them and doing the role-playing scenarios that Anthony was talking about. What are you going to do when you're faced with an ethical decision? And this is put in front of you. How are you going to handle this type of situation? How are you going to handle it when you walk in the station and you see two of your firefighters doing this or saying this? And really engaging in some hardcore weekly mentoring that develops the principle-based leaders that you want to see. Tom Peters once said, and Tom Peters is just a great leadership guru, and he said, great leaders don't create more followers. They create more leaders. So your job as a leader isn't to create a bunch of little followers behind you that say, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, whatever you want. It's to create more leaders. And one of the problems in paramilitary and military organizations is the way the structure is set up. So let's look at the fire service. If we put the fire service in a pyramid and we look at the bottom of the pyramid, the structure of the organization is the firefighters. The next step up in the pyramid would be the engineers. The next step up would be the company officers, your captains and lieutenants for departments that have lieutenants. The next step up would be your chief officers or your command staff. The next step up would be your fire chief. So here's what everyone does. They look up the pyramid. And so the firefighters and the engineers look up and they go, what does my company officer need? What do I need to make that person happy so that, you know, I get good evaluations and I'm not getting yelled at? And then the company officers look up and they go, what do my battalion chiefs want out of me? What do they expect? What do they need? What do I need to do? Command staff looks up and goes, what does the chief want? How can we all make the chief happy? So everyone's looking up. Where's the public and the customer in that? And the number one purpose of the fire service and the mission of the fire service is to protect life, property, and the environment. And so their number one customer is the public. So where's the customer in that? Well, if you flip it upside down and now you take your fire chief and you put him at the bottom, and if there's any fire chiefs listening, they're like, let me finish the point here because it's a positive thing. If you put him at the bottom, the fire chief serves as the foundation of the organization. Then the fire chief looks up to the command staff and says, how can I provide all of the tools and resources that my command staff needs to create the absolute best leaders that they can in this department? And then the command staff turns around and looks up to the company officers and says, what do my company officers need? What are the tools and resources they need to create the absolute best leaders in their crew? And then the company officers look at their crew and say, what does my team need so that we can be the best leaders? Because you don't need the title to be the leader. People often think, well, the leaders are the company officers and chief officers. No, the leaders are every single member of your department. So then the firefighters and engineers and paramedics say, all right, now we've been set this example up and down the chain. So now how do we best serve that public? That's our mission. So the focus needs to change in fire departments from looking up to your supervisor and going, you know, what do you need? How do I make you happy? To what can I equip you with to be an effective leader so that we're planning for the future leaders of our fire service? Because that is the number one issue facing the fire service today is leadership development. Because if you take care of leadership and you develop and mentor, train, and coach effective leaders from the top of the organization all the way down to the front line, you take care of every other issue. Yep. So if I asked you for a list of all the issues facing the fire service today, and this is a common question in panel interviews, and I work with departments on promotional process and things like that too. And so we'll put people through mock interviews and you'll ask, what's the number one issue facing the fire service? What do you think the number one answer is out of candidates?
Green fire engines, and why the hell did anybody paint them that color?
Close.
leadership.
No, it's never in the top 10. That's right. That's what they should say. But you know what the number one answer is? Budget. Mm-hmm. That is the number one answer in every panel interview, budget. And then they'll say things like training, succession planning. They'll say things like a hostile environment, diversity. You know, 50 mm-hmm. years ago, the fire service was a homogenous, all-white male. That's the makeup of the fire service. Today, you have diversity in religion, culture, gender. You have diversity in personality styles. Everything. And so they'll bring that up. They'll say an issue is technology, terrorism. We have to do more now since 9/11 for mass casualty incidents. Another issue facing the fire service is having to do more with less. So they'll bring all these up, but leadership will only come out of somebody's mouth about one out of every 100 candidates will say leadership. They're waiting for that question. Tell us about your leadership style. Well, I'm a role model leader. I mean, that is the number one answer. Yeah. So you won't hear leadership brought up in a context outside of tell us about your leadership style. How do you plan to lead and manage your crew? So the number one issues facing the fire, the number one issue facing the fire service is leadership, because once you take care of that, you took care of every other thing you can come up with. If you have principle-based leaders making ethical decisions and creating more leaders, then you're taking care of your succession planning, and you're not having to go outside of your fire department as often to recruit good labor.
I think what you're hearing Kim and Ed both say is that it's systematic. I think firefighters maybe don't realize sometimes that leadership is systematic. We want to follow charismatic leaders or charismatic people who are fun to be around, who seem to be very confident. When in fact, real leaders may or may not have charisma, but leaders have systems. They have a way of communicating. They have a way of running an incident, but they also have a way of running a battalion or a station or whatever. And it's a system. And so you know, Kim talks about principle-based, you know, decision-making. And that's then in itself is a system. Ed was talking about the mentoring programs that are going so well at Coronado. And that is a system. It's something that you can reinforce, teach, educate, and build upon, and it's critical. I think the building other leaders part is critical. I think we are all sitting here tonight because we agree that it's such a gap in leadership at the fire service. And I think, like Kim said, it's not about rank. I've had, about 2 weeks ago, I had a bunch of seasoned, salty truck firefighters walk up to me, guys all with 20 years plus on the job, said, you know what we're tired of? I said, what? They said, we're tired of having to feel like we need to promote to be somebody in this fire service. And they weren't speaking necessarily of my organization as much as just the fire service. It's all about promotional testing, and it's all about promotional development and future leadership and future officers. And it's like, wait a minute. You guys are leadership is not defined by a rank or the color of your helmet or your paycheck. It's simply look behind you. Are people following you or not? And good or bad. And what these guys failed to, I looked at each of them, I said, how can you say you're not leaders? I looked at one of them, I said, you're involved in our SCBA program, and you're a very much a leader because people know that you have street credibility as a truck firefighter. The other one, I said, you've been on a truck and or a rescue company for most of your career that I've known you, and I know guys that would follow you into hell. You are leaders. So I think as part of this, the undercurrent of this discussion, we need to remember that leadership is not a rank, like Kim said, but really say that to the firefighters listening out there, that this isn't about a promotional process. This is about a behavioral process, and it's defined, and that's what leadership is defined by. One of the questions you asked was about other mentoring skills or techniques. One that I just popped into my head as Kim was talking was that I like to bring along those few, maybe in the 9 or 10% that I was talking about, that have potential to be the 1%, or some of those that are floating around in 80% land that have potential to be the 9 or 10%. Identify who they are and put them in positions to not only excel but to learn. For example, if I'm going to have an operations meeting with my ops chief, I'm going to bring one of my captains with me because he is interested in the topic, or he is teaching the topic, or whatever. I want him to see the interaction. I want him to be exposed to that meeting and that level and understand some of the other things that, that go on in those kinds of meetings and seek out opportunities for these individuals to participate in the bigger picture and come to meetings that seem to be closed door. No, you're invited to this meeting. Well, why? I actually had one of my captains come to a meeting, and he thought, "Well, I don't know if the ops chief wants me there." I said, "Well, one, I'm sure he'd be happy if you were there, and two, I want you there." Now, I'm not telling you have to come, but I'm telling you that you're welcome. And sure enough, the ops chief had no problem with it; was happy to have him there, and his participation in the meeting was great, and he learned a few things that maybe he wouldn't have if I just had my nice little meeting and came down and gave him the cliff notes. So I think we have to be vigilant to find opportunities to mentor. And I think that we need to realize that leadership will cost us. It costs you. If you're doing all the mentoring like Kim and Ed are talking about, that costs you time as an individual, costs you sleep probably. You're probably up later and up earlier than most of the people that you're leading. And those are all key components of the foundation of leadership, I think. And I think we're all kind of on the same page on what we're saying, which is, there's a huge void, and we need to do something about it, because the symptoms that we're seeing, the lawsuits, litigation, the fatalities on the fire ground, the issues that Kim brought up, there's a whole host of issues. And being in California takes it to a whole new level as far as being the litigious society that Kim mentioned. We are so entitled in this state. Oh, my goodness. We are so entitled. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's amazing how I think the perception of the aspiring officer is that if I get this new job, I'm going to get sued mm-hmm. for doing my job. And that's a fear that I'm seeing in a lot of new aspiring officers. They're afraid to take on the role because they don't want to be sued for doing their job or be told or accused of harassment or God knows what. And that I think is part of the problem that we're seeing right now.
And you're much more likely as an officer to get sued for not doing your job. The saying is, be a manager, go to jail, which applies to if you are in a supervisory position and you have knowledge that something's going on and you don't enforce policy or do something about it, you can be held personally liable for it, which can include jail time if it's bad enough. And that's where the saying comes from. That used to be the standard. The standard is now, if you're a supervisor in a company officer position and you knew about something or should have known about it, you can be held liable, because a company officer has a higher level of accountability to know the crew members. So when they say, "Well, I didn't know Joe had a drinking problem and was going to get behind the wheel of the engine and kill somebody." Well, you should have known. Three other people in the department knew, and you're his company officer. You absolutely should have known. So I think company officers need to be a little more leery of not doing their job and getting sued. I want to hit on one other quick thing on mentoring and succession planning. In my opinion, I think it's the most important thing for you as the company officer or chief officer, setting the example that we've been talking about tonight. And that is, you better have a passion and a love for what you do. If you don't absolutely love getting up every day and being in the fire service, and you are just waiting to drop and get your retirement paycheck and you cannot wait to get out, you are in the wrong field. It doesn't mean you love every aspect of your job. It doesn't mean you agree with all the politics that go on. It doesn't mean that you think everyone in your department is just awesome from the top all the way down to the front line. But what it means is you feel that you're doing this for a reason. You have a passion and a purpose for it in life. And if you don't, you need to do yourself, the fire service, the public, and everyone around you a favor and get the hell out. Because it's hurting you and it's hurting other people. And you will squelch leadership ability, and you will squelch people's willingness to step forward and want to take on leadership positions if you're setting that type of example. You're going to poison rookies coming into the fire service with your cynicism and your negative attitude towards the policies of the department and towards the management of the department. And so if you don't at least love what you do in being in the fire service, then my recommendation is don't do it, because you're not going to have good mentoring and you're not going to have good succession planning without people that love what they do.
Amen to that.
One last question before we wrap up, and maybe I'm completely off the hook or off the page on this one, but the old saying, having come from the East Coast, is keep your mouth shut and your eyes open, or your ears open for the first couple of years. You talk about finding people when you're in the interview process before they're even a member of the department. When is it, or is it too early to start as soon as they get into the department, I guess once they finish their probationary academy? When's a good time to really start feeling them out to become officers?
You're asking me.
I'll start with you.
You looking at me?
You looking at me? Again, I believe an organization is nothing, is no different than a professional sports team, professional sports franchise. You need to recruit people into your organization that fit your organization. Now, when I say recruit, I mean it from a standpoint of how do you write your job application? What are the qualifications? What are the character? What are the wants and needs of the organization that are based on that job flyer? And as that individual goes through the testing process, and you have a comprehensive testing process, that allows you to determine whether or not that individual is going to be appropriate for your organization. Now, any chief officer should be telling you that we are building from the time we test people to become members of our family, and that's what we are, is we're a family. From the time that we bring people into our family, we are preparing them to achieve whatever level of success in that organization they wish to achieve. I agree 100% with Anthony, is that some of your greatest leaders are firefighters. And in fact, a very famous firefighter who unfortunately died in the line of duty in an arson fire in the city of Riverside was Ed Turan. Ed was a firefighter his entire career, and yet Ed was probably the strongest leader in the city of Riverside Fire Department, to an extent that he is never, nor will he ever be forgotten. The same holds true with a company officer out of LA City, Lane Kemper. These people weren't fire chief. These people weren't deputy chiefs. These people were boots to the ground leaders. And the reason they were leaders is because they created a belief. Now, let me regress and say, as a chief officer, as a human resources department, in a collaboration effort to build your organization for the future, which is all that we want to do. We want to pay it forward. We want to leave it better than we found it. When you're bringing people into your family, you need to look at them and say, are these future leaders? Whether it's a future fire chief or whether it's a future firefighter, are they future leaders in our department? And that's what's important for us to look at. So I say one of the things that we do we recently graduated our recruits and out of the academy, and we had a badge pinning ceremony. And in that badge pinning ceremony, we invited their family to the badge pinning ceremony. Now, this was not for the department. This was for their family. It wasn't even for them. I made it a personal decision, as I've done previously many times before, to go up to every mom, dad, husband, wife of that firefighter recruit, and I say very simple words: thank you for allowing me to have the pleasure to work with your loved one. Thank you for loaning your loved one to me during the time that they're away from their family. I promise you that there will be times that they will go home angry, they will go home tired, they will go home banged up, and they'll go home exalted because they fought, you know, the perfect fire. But I promise you I will do everything possible to send them home. And that's my job as a chief officer, is to send them home. When you look at your people as family members, and you look at their loved ones in the eye, and you make that promise, then and only then can you bring people into an organization that truly fit that organization and make that organization what it should be, which is a collaboration of a group of disciplines that serve the community to its best needs. And that's what we do. We start it from day one, and we do it all the way through the retirement. When you get a 30-year service retirement, you get a bell. And that's your bell. You know, so that's, I mean, I'm not saying that that's the best way, but it's a way that we found to work best for us.
Okay. I think a way that would work too, I think you have to look at the generation coming in, and I like to call them, and I think a lot of us call them different things. One phrase that's out there is the Y generation, because X used to be X, now it's Y. Well, also Y. They want to know why. They're very inquisitive, and they could. But the funny thing is, and you talk to the older firefighters, and they're frustrated because they're feeling that today's the new firefighters coming on don't have the mechanical aptitude, work experience, or military experience, or traditional values that they had. So they may not have pushed a lawnmower or a broom or a mop before. So there's a lot of why questions, like questions that frustrate senior firefighters and make them want to look at these kids and go, you know what, get out of my sight. I don't want to deal with you. So if the kids coming in are perceived that way, then the thought of making them in charge or putting them as an officer is ludicrous in some people's minds. However, if we flip it around and look at it from a different perspective, maybe we can capture these potential leaders. And even if they don't ever promote, they can show the importance of the leadership trait of caring for one another like family. So one of the thoughts that we've had and we've tossed around is, what if the day you get off probation, you not only get off probation, but you're awarded by becoming a mentor? In other words, you now just got off of your 1 year probation and just became a mentor of the guy who just got off probation. So that invests that former probie for a second year. Because what we've often seen in the fire service is they get off probation and a metamorphosis takes place. They shed that outer skin and all of a sudden they become, like, you know, we call them 2 and 20s. They've been around 2 years, they act like they've been around 20. All of a sudden they have the walk and they stick their helmet in a barbecue and all of a sudden they've been to every fire and they know everything there's to know and all this stuff. And that frustrates the senior guys. But what if they were just a mentor of just a brand new guy? So what you're mentoring them is not on the finer points of firefighting, opening a roof, or how to open up a roll-up door. You're mentoring them on how to get through probation, on how to learn and get your task book signed off. Not how to get a pencil whipped, but to be that shoulder to cry on. Hey, you know what? I think I screwed up. It's my first day, and I think I already screwed it up. You might not want to tell the captain that, but maybe the guy that's in the firehouse with you who just got off probation, who knows the ropes and has been in your shoes, bottom line, that might be somebody who you would confide in. So I think that would invest those probies, the people who just got probation a second year. And in so doing, even if they never promote, you're giving them that core value. You're brainwashing them to say, you know what, we invest in each other. We invest in, and then that counters the typical firefighter mentality, which says, I just got out of probation, you're the new guy, now, you know, it flows downhill, buddy, and now you're going to get it. I just got it for a past year, now I'm giving it to you. But instead of that, we switch it over now and make you a leader by mentoring this new guy. Then, take a step further. When you're done with your year of mentoring, your third year, you get mentored by a senior guy. Now, the guy that's on the truck, the guy that's been around 20 years, who doesn't want to promote or just wants to be on a truck forever, or an engine or whatever, or an engineer, whoever. These are the folks that are mentoring the 3 year and above guys, and teaching them the finer points of opening a roof, the finer parts of the craft and the art of firefighting. And then we need to identify mentors for engineers who want to go through the engineer process, for captains. Ed mentioned task books earlier. There should be a task book process, an academy for the aspiring officer, and then a mentor to go to. So if you can't remember how to write the report correctly, or you have a question on a judgment call, you could call your boss, but maybe you call your mentor who's been in the seat that you're in now, who's been in it for 5 years, 10 years, or whatever. So I think if everybody has a vested interest in somebody else, even if it's just one more person in the organization, that's going to build that cohesion and also identify those future leaders and potential officers of the future.
Okay.
And I think the concept of keep your mouth shut and your ears open, the idea behind that is be open to learning. So if you're listening more and you're talking less, maybe you're learning more. So if the concept is learning, which it is, and that's what we want, learning requires asking questions. And so sometimes that requires opening your mouth. And I think what people need to be real careful of is not confusing the why generation with a legitimate why question.
Exactly.
Because unfortunately, the why generation is often this. Why? Why do I have to do it? Why now? Whatever. Okay. And that's irritating. And those senior officers have every right to say, get out of my face. You are driving me nuts. But they confuse that with this. A respectful, why do we do it this way? And so they're questioning process. And they're questioning process oftentimes because they might have a better idea on how to improve process. But a senior officer might say, get out of my face, you're the Y generation. And they're dismissing the validity of their ideas, input, and creativity, which is a big mistake. Now, for those of you out there who don't know Captain Mike Abershoff, he took over the USS Benfold, which is a billion-dollar warship, at the age of 36 years old. He was the captain of a warship at the age of 36. And when he took over this warship, it had the highest attrition rate of any ship in the U.S. Navy, 70% attrition rate. 70% of any person who got on that ship could not wait to get off, did not renew their contract. In a two-year period, because that's all you get as a captain of a warship, 2 years, in a two-year period, he took a 70% attrition rate and he dropped it down to zero. And how he did that, the first thing he did when he got on that ship is he went and interviewed all 311 crew members and he said, why are you here? Why did you join the Navy? What do you hope to get out of it? What do you want to do with your career? This is your ship. What can we do to make it better? Now, these enlisted people who are not used to ever having their input solicited by officers, much less the captain of the ship, are a little bit surprised. So one of them gets up the nerve to give him input. All right, I'll give you some input. We are painting the ship 6 times a year. Our purpose for being here is emergency readiness. It's killing morale. Everyone hates it. You know, we need to make a change. And the captain said, all right, well, your input is legitimate, and I'm assuming you have a better idea. You're not just coming to me with problems, but with solutions. And the enlisted person said, young, frontline, perceived Y generation, said, here's my idea. Why don't we remove all of the bolts off of the ship and replace them with stainless steel fasteners that don't rust? So we don't have the rust streaks going down the boat. I mean, we're the U.S. Navy. We can't float around the waters looking horrible, so we understand it needs to look good. Why don't we replace them with stainless steel fasteners? And the captain said, that is a genius idea. How come nobody's thought of that? So he calls the Navy supply yard and asks them for stainless steel fasteners. And they said, well, yeah, we have a few. We don't have enough to cover an entire ship. Now, most people would be pretty satisfied with their supervisor going through that much trouble and going to bat for them. But he didn't stop there. He took the Navy credit card and he went to Home Depot and he bought all the stainless steel fasteners they would need to replace them out on the ship. He did it. They paint the ship now twice a year instead of 6 times a year. And today, every ship in the U.S. Navy uses stainless steel fasteners. Because one young Y generation mentality person shared an idea that a senior officer had enough humility and confidence in his own leadership to listen to him, take the idea, and implement the idea. And that's good leadership. So the idea that you have young people who can't come in and immediately be considered for officer positions, and Anthony's idea is great into moving them into that eventually, but don't be afraid to listen to them. Because the people closest to the problems always have the best solutions. And the fresh ideas that are coming into the fire service are usually some of the best ideas. Now, if you're one of the Y generations listening to this right now, please hear me on this. Do it with respect. Don't go challenging process because you think you know all the answers and you do it with an attitude because nobody's going to listen to you. But if you do it humbly and with respect, people will want to hear your input a whole lot easier.
I think that one of the problems we're having with leadership training and just leadership in the fire service is that, by and large, the fire service is a very physical job. We love it. You go, I roved around in the hands-on training today, and I also walked around the classroom training, and there was 3-4 times as many people at the hands-on. Why? Because it's more fun. And
well, unless you're in my class.
Of course. Present company excluded. Anyway, so we're task-oriented. We're reactive. Those two things are a bad combination for leaders. Because task-oriented and reactive don't... Tasks aren't necessarily a leadership skill. That's management. That's getting stuff done. Leadership is about people, and it's about being proactive. So we're great and have been great at teaching hose evolutions, SCBAs, ladders, saws, cutting holes. But isn't it interesting that we can do those things pretty well? We enjoy doing them well. We spend most of our training hours doing task-level things. But when it comes to tactical level things, we start to cut. You see the decline now. Now you're talking about command training and things that are not put my hand on it, you know, grunt through it kind of stuff. And then we get to strategic level, and it drops off the map. And that's where the most proactive stuff lives. But we as a fire service don't like living there. We just don't like being that way. We were raised, like Kim mentioned earlier, what do we do? What do we spend our whole life doing? That's what we're going to do at the moment of truth. We come in as rookie firefighters and spend our whole careers, 20 years worth, as Pavlov's dog. When the bell rings, Mongo gets up, gets on truck, goes, puts fire out, comes back. Done. And so we wait around for the bell to ring. Well, as a battalion chief or a fire chief, you can't wait for the bell to ring. You need to know that the bell's going to ring and prevent it from ringing in the first place. At the tactical level, that's the battalion chief who's got enough training to see a roof collapse before it happens and pull his troops out. It's the fire chief who can see that the weeds in the garden are starting to take hold and get roots and are going to uproot the flowers in the garden and does something about it proactively. And I just don't think as a fire service, because the nature of our business is emergency services, we don't like to plan. We don't like to think ahead. We don't live in the strategic world. So when we talk about succession planning on all levels, especially the upper levels, like the fire chief's levels, it gets more and more difficult. It gets more and more difficult to find people who really have vision, who really think, you know, the cliche out of the box, and who are willing to take risks. It just doesn't seem like it's something that comes naturally to the fire service in general because of the nature of our business.
Okay. Again, this is Radio at Firehouse.com. We are here at Firehouse World with Kim Allen, Anthony Castros, and Ed Hadfield. We discussed several topics on leadership, and I appreciate all of you joining us today. And again, for those listening, thank you for joining us, and please do take a look at the links at the bottom of the podcast player page so you can learn a little bit more about the folks who joined us today.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.